2012, February 21st. It is Astronomy 141, Lecture 32, Meet the Neighbors. Yesterday, we started our discussion of life on other stars by talking about the properties of the stars themselves. I want to take a break from sort of the discussion of the physics of stars, which will motivate a lot of what we're doing for this section, and talk a little bit about basically introducing you to our stellar neighbors. So today's lecture is called Meet the Neighbors. It's about the solar neighborhood. We're going to look at the nearest stars to the sun and then beyond out into our Milky Way. We're going to set part of the scale of the problem, how big the interstellar distances are, but also start framing the problem in terms of what kind of stars are found around us. We saw last time the stars come in many different temperatures, many different luminosities. We saw the main sequence, the giants and supergiants. But let's do a little quick census of what it is around us, because this is the first place we're going to go looking for planets that could be possible harbors for life. So we're going to note a couple of facts today. One of them is that the nearest star to the sun is a little under 4.25 light years away. It's a little red dwarf star named Proxima Centauri. It's off in the direction of the southern hemisphere constellation of the Centaur. The nearest sun-like star, which is something that might excite interest in looking for life, is look for stars like our sun of about, roughly comparable age, is a star named Alpha Centauri, which is about 4.36 light years away. That actually turns out to be the brightest star in a triple star system. It's a G-type star. There's also a K-star in the system that forms a tight binary. And Proxima is the third star further out. And we'll see a little bit about that in a second. But if we go beyond just the immediate neighbor, we can define something called the solar neighborhood. Now, this is a fairly loose definition, so I'm going to pick a fairly conservative definition of all the stars within 15 light years. But bear in mind that you're going to see definitions out there as much as 250 light years around the sun. So it's a kind of a loose definition, but I'm going to start nearby and then we'll expand outwards. If we expand the sphere of stars around us and do a quick census as to what kind of stars we find, what we find is that most nearby stars are red dwarfs, these cool M-type main sequence stars. And we're going to see what implications that has for what fraction of stars we think might be likely harbors for life-bearing planets. And then finally, want to put the system of stars in the solar neighborhood in context by reminding you that the sun is but one of nearly 200 billion stars that makes up the Milky Way galaxy. And we'll say a little bit about the scale and appearance of the Milky Way, because ultimately our search for planets around other stars, and hopefully the search for life around those stars, is going to extend not just simply to our solar neighborhood, but is now beginning to reach out into the entire Milky Way galaxy itself. We'll say a little bit about the structure of that, because it bears on the type of searches that are going on for looking for just those planets around other stars. So today we're going to be meeting the neighbors. We're going to look out beyond the solar system and see what's around us in space in the Milky Way galaxy. Let's start by just asking, once I leave the solar system, where's the outer edge of the solar system? And the answer is the outer edge of the solar system is about 100 astronomical units out, up to about 120 astronomical units, which is about the point at which the solar wind collides with the interstellar medium, and the two basically form a little shock wave where there's the transition between interplanetary space and interstellar space, the space between the stars. 100 astronomical units sounds like an awful lot. We've taken decades to get a single spacecraft, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, out that far. But that's nothing compared to the distances between stars. The nearest stars are 200,000 astronomical units away. And in fact, we're going to drop the use of astronomical units and pick up a unit we talked about in the first week of class, the light year. We really have to now start talking about the distance light can travel in 1 year, which is a few trillion kilometers in distance. So if we look out in nearby space, there's vast emptiness after we leave the solar system. It's a lot of interstellar gas. It's mostly fairly hot, thin gas. So thin that the average density of gas around us, around the sun, is like one hydrogen atom for every few hundred cubic centimeters. I probably got that number wrong. But basically, it's way empty. We go out through this space, we don't encounter another star until we travel nearly 4.25 light years. So it takes light, which is the fastest thing in the universe, 4.25 years to traverse that distance just to the next star over. So it gives you some idea of the vastness of the depths of interstellar space. That star is named Proxima Centauri. The Proxima obviously has been assigned because it's the nearest star to the sun. And Centauri refers to the constellation that it resides in. This is a southern hemisphere constellation of the Centaur. It's barely visible from the northern hemisphere. You'd have to go down south to Hawaii to see the Centaurus from the northern hemisphere, at least see the entire constellation. I've only seen the entire constellation myself from Chile, which is 30 degrees south of the equator. If we look at Proxima Centauri, and we've now got a computer rendering here of the sun with its approximate color and scale, Proxima Centauri is a middle M-type red giant. And just to set the scale for that, there's the proper scale for Jupiter. So these are all in their proper sizes. And you can see that a red dwarf really does merit the name dwarf. If we look at the details of Proxima Centauri, it's about 12% the mass of the sun and only about 15% its radius. But its mass is, this luminosity is tiny. It's barely 17 ten-thousandths the luminosity of the sun. So it's a really faint star. In fact, it is not visible to the naked eye. Proxima Centauri is only visible in photographic or imaging techniques. You cannot see it. It's 100 times fainter than what we can see with the naked eye. For those of you who know anything about amateur astronomy, you know there's a couple in this class. It's approximately of the 10th magnitude. So the 5th magnitude is the faintest stars we can see. So the nearest star, it kind of looks like not much of a star. But as we're going to see later, that shouldn't surprise the nearest star was a red dwarf, because in fact, red dwarfs are the most common denizens of the local solar of the local galaxy. Now let's try to get some idea about setting sort of the scale of things, because one of the things that's important in thinking about interstellar space is starting to get in your head just how really vast the distances are between the stars. So we're going to use as our scaling something sort of every day, and that is, if the sun were about 4.27 centimeters in diameter, that sounds very specific, that is in fact a PGA regulation golf ball in diameter, we make the sun a golf ball and say, where is Proxima, and standing here in Columbus, Ohio, where is Proxima Centauri? Proxima Centauri would basically be a marble, a little red marble, smaller than a regulation marble, by the way, located just outside of Salt Lake City, Utah, some long, long ways away, about 2,500 kilometers away. So basically, this distance of 2.24 light years away is 268,000 astronomical units. Compare that with the fact that the outer edge of our solar system, in round numbers, is at 100 astronomical units. So the distance between where we cross from inside of what we would say physically is kind of our solar system to interstellar space, to get to the next star, we have to traverse that same distance more than 2,600 times. So the distances between the stars are really, really vast. And this affects a lot of our considerations about looking at the question, especially if we decided, if we actually go out and eventually, and I believe we will, eventually find an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of its star, and we find signatures of possible life on that world. Well, part of what we're developing in this section is what those signatures are and how we do the search. The desire to go there is going to become absolutely overwhelming, because there is another place for life on the surface of a planet that could be very much like the Earth. Maybe it might even be a new home for humanity in the future as our own sun ages. The problem is the vast distances involved. One of your homework problems has you work with some of these numbers. It's a sort of typical distance rate time problem. Let's take the very fastest spacecraft we've built to date, and that's Voyager 1. Voyager 1, in terms of speed, now I'm referring to speed at the time that it escapes from the sun's gravity. So Voyager 1 was launched from in the 1970s. It was sent originally to Jupiter, past Saturn. It's in fact survived all those many years since it was launched, and is now on its way out of the solar system. The gravity slingshot that it received from the combination of the gravity of Jupiter and Saturn was sufficient to accelerate the Voyager spacecraft, both Voyager 1 and its sister ship, Voyager 2, beyond the escape speed for the gravity of the sun. So it truly is now an interstellar spacecraft. It has actually left the solar system. As of this month, February 2012, The Voyager 1 spacecraft, which is the most distant spacecraft ever sent out by human beings, is now 120 astronomical units from the Earth. It is, in fact, in the transition zone between interplanetary and interstellar space. It's not a sharp line chalked in space that says, you know, now you're with the Sun, now you're with interstellar. It's actually a fairly broad zone where the transition occurs, and it's right in that transition zone now. To put that in human terms, it's 18 billion kilometers away, moving at a speed of 61,400 kilometers an hour, or for those of us inveterate English users, that's 38,200 miles an hour. So this thing's flat cooking. This thing is the fastest thing that human beings have ever been able to make. There have been instantaneous speeds, which are faster in terms of launch speed at the Earth, but the subsequent gravitational slingshots have made it faster. If you look on the web, the New Horizons spacecraft currently bound for Pluto claims to be the fastest spacecraft ever made. It was the fastest spacecraft at launch from Earth orbit, but by and far the winner is Voyager 1. So let's say, now in fact it turns out the direction it's going in space is not actually towards any particular star. It's actually just going to where the last slingshot sent it. So it's not been directed to visit a nearby star. But let's say we were to build a spacecraft like Voyager 2 and decide we wanted to send it to the nearest star, which is Proxima Centauri, and now I'm going to express it not as 4.25 light years, but 4.024 times 10 to the 13 kilometers, about 40 trillion kilometers away. Well, if you're moving at a speed of 61,400 kilometers an hour, but you've got to cover 40 trillion kilometers, it would take that Voyager 1-like spacecraft 74,000 years to make the trip between the Earth and Proxima Centauri. Therein lies part of the problem of consideration of interstellar spaces. We haven't even left our backyard yet. It took us a couple of decades, actually 3 decades, to get through our backyard or more. And yet it would take us 74 millennia just to reach the next yard. That's the vastness of interstellar space. And that's the tremendous challenge of bridging those interstellar spaces. If we're going to look for and find life, going there is going to be immensely challenging. And in some later lectures in this course, we're going to talk about that in some detail. But for now, I want to just sort of keep this in the back of your mind. We're talking about vast empty here, and we're only just getting started. And your homework problem has you see just how vast and empty and big things are in space. So it's a totally different scale and way of thinking of things. So if we go out past Proxima, we find that Proxima is actually 1/3 of a triple star system, a gravitationally bound system consisting of 2 fairly bright stars, a nearly perfect solar analog, although it's a little bit brighter than our Sun. It's about 10% brighter than the Sun, called Alpha Centauri A. A companion star called Alpha Centauri B, which is a K star, a slightly cooler version of like our Sun. It's about half the luminosity of our Sun and about 90% the Sun's mass. Alpha Centauri A is about 10% more massive than the Sun and about 50% more luminous. Backwards just a little second ago. Proxima we've already met. Putting them on scale, again, these are my little computer-generated stellar models. This is our Sun in scale to Proxima, Alpha, Centauri A, and B. It's a binary system. The binary system is about a little over 4 1/3 light years away, 4.37 light years in the center. And it's a triple system. They actually orbit around each other with a relatively slow period of a few years. Such systems are actually relatively common. We call these particular types of triple systems hierarchical triples. You have a pair of stars in the middle that are relatively close to each other within a few astronomical units, and then a very distant partner a long ways away making up that third. The Sun is actually slightly unique, relatively speaking, or in terms of being a solo star in space. A lot, as we're going to see, of stars in space are binary stars. But this is the nearest star system to our own. A Sun-like star, a K-type star, and a distant red dwarf. Now, the first sight, you might think that a binary star might not be such a great place to go looking for planets. But in fact, it's not crazy. We've in fact discovered planets around other binary star systems, if not the Alpha Centauri AB system. The search is going on. It seems like if you're going to look for planets around a nearby star, why not look at the nearest by stars? For a long time, people thought, in fact, the fact that this is a binary star, 2 stars orbiting each other, makes for a very complicated orbital environment between these two. they kind of wrote it off as a possibility for having any kind of stable planets. But in fact, that's not true. So what I've shown here is a scale model of the Alpha Centauri AB system. Proxima's way out of the building, off down towards the oval somewhere. The two stars are separated by 11 astronomical units. To put that in perspective for the solar system, remember that Saturn is 9.5 astronomical units. So these things orbit each other at about the separation of Saturn from the Sun. Now, if you look at that, you can compute what the habitable zones are around Alpha Centauri A and B. We'll say more about that in detail, but we did that the other day for the Sun. That's shown by the green bands here. So those are the regions where we expect, if there was an Earth-like planet, where we would have about 1 atmosphere of pressure on a solid surface and normal composition, that it is possible, not required, but possible for that surface to have stable liquid water on its surface. And this is an instantaneous measure in terms of what's going on with the brightness of the stars these days. So that's where the habitable zones are. The dashed line that you see around there in yellow is a calculation of the gravity of, put a planet down in a system with the gravity of two stars orbiting around each other and ask, is the orbit stable or not? And the answer would be, if you're outside those dotted circles, say out in the interspace here between the two stars, your orbit will become unstable. You will be alternately tugged by alpha A and alpha B back and forth, and you'll kind of do this sort of meandering loop-de-loops around there. And in fact, if you're perturbed in enough way, you might fall into one of those stars or pick up enough energy to be tossed out of the system entirely. So orbits in there are not stable. They're not long-lived. You can either get tossed into one or other of the two stars or get an extra kick of energy and be tossed out of the system into interstellar space altogether. But if you're inside this yellow circle relative to each of the stars, there is a zone of stability in which the gravity of the star is stronger than the mutual changing gravitational field of the orbital pair, and you actually can set up a stable orbit. And what's, of course, interesting to us from the perspective of the Alpha Cent A and Alpha Cent B system is the stable orbit for both is approximately 2 astronomical units. They're not that different in size, so we're being kind of generous with the limits. But I've plotted on top of that a series of white circles is superimposing the orbits of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars inside that circle to show you that our Sun's system of terrestrial planets would be located relative to these stars inside the stability zone. So looking for planets around a binary star system like Alpha Centauri AB is not crazy. And as we'll see when we talk about the actual discoveries of extrasolar planets next week, Monday, we'll see, in fact, we found a couple of planetary systems around binary star systems, one of which got a lot of press last year because it's orbiting far away from one of these hierarchical triples. So if you had a planet, if you stood on the surface of that planet or a moon of that planet, you would see two suns orbiting around each other plus a third in the distance. It got dubbed Tatooine for the similar system in the Star Wars films. So these things are not crazy. The habitable zones are located inside of the zones of stability. It's kind of a good thing that we can use binary stars as a place to look for life, because binaries and even hierarchical triples like Alpha Centauri AB are actually pretty common. So this is our local neighbors. These are the immediate next door neighbors, and it's an interesting pair. But let's go out beyond that. Let's sort of expand our view around the Sun. And now I'm going to pick fairly arbitrarily, but not entirely, a circle that's 15 light years in radius, so 30 light years in diameter around the Sun. If I look at that, I find within that circle there are 56 stars in 38 systems. And a system is defined as a gravitationally bound group of stars and potentially planets orbiting around each other. 24 of the 56 stars are single stars, including of which is the Sun is one. 10 are binary systems that contain only two stars, and 4, including Alpha Centauri AB with Proxima, are these so-called triple star systems. The first thing you notice from these numbers is that half of all stars in round numbers come in multiples. They come either in doubles or triples. So the Sun is actually in a relative minority among stars of its type for being a solo star with nothing in orbit around it but a system of planets. But what you also notice is within this volume, the fact that within this circle, 15 arc, 15 light years in diameter around the sun, is we haven't even broken 100 stars yet. This is a very vastly empty place. The density of stars is roughly 4 stars for 1,000 cubic light years. So imagine a cube, 10 light years on a side. There would be only 4 stars within that volume. Think about it for a second. Remember, 10 light years is more than two and change, larger than the distance just from the sun to Alpha Centauri. So if I plop that cube down here anywhere, I'm going to count on average 4 stars. It's a big empty spot. Now, the average distance between the stars in the local solar neighborhood when I do the calculation up is about 6 light years. Again, it's an average. Some are closer, some are further away. But that 6 light year number is one to keep in mind. At the current technologies that we possess of spacecraft we've actually launched, the average time of travel between stars in our solar neighborhood is 100,000 years for a Voyager-type spacecraft. That means if we want to even get out of the local solar neighborhood and just go out and meet the neighbors, we are going to have to come up with technologies that allow us to move a lot faster. So this is one of the main big challenges is the depths of space here. And also the emptiness of the space. It's a fairly small volume to survey. We can expand the space outwards a bit. We go out to about 300 within 10 parsecs. So this is a circle now not 15 light years across, but a little over 30 light years across. So I'm now going to double the distance, and I'm going to increase the volume by a factor of 8 in the sphere around the sun. And we're just going to do a census. One of the reasons for choosing this sphere is within that sphere, I'm still sensitive. I'm pretty sure I've got a pretty complete census of all the stars within that volume. As I go further and further away, the faintest stars become fainter and fainter, and they're harder to detect because I have to go so faint. I'm starting to get to the point where I'm going to confuse them with more distant, brighter stars. So this sort of 10 parsec, or it says up here on the axis, a parsec is about 3.25 light years, so about 32 light year diameter. I'm reasonably complete, not 100%, but complete enough statistically I can fill in the gaps. And I make a kind of a population curve, kind of like a grade curve. This, a grade curve is a score here. The score is the luminosity of the star in units of the luminosity of the sun. And then the vertical axis counts simply how many stars fall in that bin. Now, you'll notice this is a logarithmic interval. These things are set up in factors of 100 for each tick. So this is a 100 solar luminosity star, a 1 solar luminosity star. That's, in fact, the sun is one of those in this bin. 1/100th, or 1% of the luminosity of the sun, and 1/10,000th the luminosity of the sun, 10 to the minus 4. The first thing that becomes immediately apparent is most of the stars, the peak of this histogram, is very low luminosity stars. The peak of this histogram is red dwarfs. Stars like the sun are out on the tail of the distribution in the local volume. In fact, in this particular diagram, there are, if I did the scaling, I think it's 9 or 10. I forget exactly how the scaling works. And for this particular diagram, I cribbed off the web at the last minute. There are only 9 or 10 stars like the sun in terms of mass, meaning 1 solar luminosity, inside of that 30 light year radius circle. There are no superluminous stars, 100 solar luminosity kinds of stars. So this is what we're looking at. This is what our neighbors look like. We are unusual in a couple of different ways, we meaning the sun and the system around it. We are a single star, something less than half of all stars like the sun, half or less, are single stars. Most of the rest are binaries and doubles and triples. The second is, we are a 1 solar mass, 1 solar luminosity star. Those are relatively rare. By and large, most stars are red dwarfs. They're much cooler, and they're much fainter than us. That's going to have some implications for what kind of planetary systems these things are going to possess. They're cooler, fainter stars. It's going to put their habitable zones much closer together. We're going to say a lot more about that on Thursday. Now, if I remember the other day, yesterday, in fact, we talked about the stellar classification sequence, O, B, A, F, G, K, and M. These are the spectral classifications of stars. They run from the hot O stars at 50,000 degrees Kelvin down to the M stars at about 3,000 Kelvin. I've dropped the L dwarfs off the bottom of this one because we actually do not have a sufficient census of the local L dwarfs to know how to really put them into this diagram. So I'm going to drop those off for, not because they aren't there, but because we just don't have enough information yet. What I've done is now digested that previous diagram and talked about what percent of stars fall in this category out to a reasonable distance, a reasonable circle around the sun. And what I find is that stars like the sun, these G-type stars, 5,000 degrees, kind of a light yellowish color, are only 7% of nearby stars. 75% are red dwarfs, are these M stars. So stars like the sun are relatively rare. So that's the first piece of information we've learned by looking at the local neighbors, is that if we want to find planets around sun-like stars, Earth-like planets in the habitable zones of sun-like stars, we've already rejected from that search 93% of nearby stars as places to look. So maybe we've got to broaden our search a bit. Well, I can maybe go to slightly hotter stars, and we're going to see there are some issues as to how far we can push this, but I don't get a lot of gain. I only get a couple percent in this direction. The gain is probably going to be going to cooler stars. For example, if we broaden our search out to K stars and up to F stars, I get 2 and 7 is 9 plus 15 brings me up to 23%. So that's a big change. If I can actually bring M stars into the fold, that actually greatly increases the number of stars I could search for planets. But there's a downside. Those stars are 10,000 times fainter than the sun, which means I can't see them very far away. So it's going to be much more challenging to search for fainter stars. So everybody's got a trade-off. The bright stars, as we're going to see, are too bright, extremely rare, and have some properties that probably make them relatively inhospitable. The fainter stars, there's a whole bunch of them, but they're kind of faint. That may make difficulty for habitability. It will actually reduce the size of the habitability zone. And some other interesting effects occur when you get down to the M stars that we'll see on Thursday. So we're really going to be searching a relatively rare middle zone, kind of sun-like stars, a little hotter, a little cooler, and we're arguing right now among ourselves as astronomers as to how far down we can push into cool stars as places where we can look for life. The other thing this means is let's just take a totally provincial view of searching for life. We want to find Earth-like planets around sun-like stars in those stars' habitable zones. And I restrict myself to G stars. In order to look for such things, I'm going to have to extend out to larger and larger volumes. After all, within that 30 light-year radius sphere around the sun, there are only 9 or 10 G stars. And if the probability of finding a planet like that is only a few percent, we don't know what the fractions are now, we're trying to figure that out, to get decent statistics on the averages, we're going to have a lot more G-stars, which means we're going to have to go a lot further away than just our solar neighborhood. So while the solar neighborhood is the obvious place to go looking for planets around other stars and be looking for possible life-bearing planets, just the numbers alone and the vastness of the distances of space are pretty much telling us we're going to have to go to much larger distances, and it makes the problem very challenging. So this is part of the point of today, is looking at what the local neighborhood's like kind of sets the stage for what our search is going to look like. So let's see what those spaces look like. Here's a couple of nice plots that show this. This is a circle going out 35 light years around the sun. So this is the volume from which that histogram plot was taken. And you see there's a few bright blue stars like Vega, Altair, Fomalhaut. These are very hot blue stars. The colors here are not great, Sirius. You see yellow stars, K stars. There's a couple of giants are starting to pop in here, but mostly we see nice sun-like and red dwarf stars. And we haven't actually plotted all the red dwarfs on this plot. They're too small to actually be easily visible. If we go out to 65 light years, we start picking up some very large giant and supergiant stars. We start picking up stars like Arcturus, which is a supergiant star. So as we go out, we start picking up a much more diverse population. We start getting into some of these evolved stars, and we're going to get into a great number of challenges. These things are getting a lot further away. A few of these stars, in fact, are places where we have found planets. For example, you'll notice that some of these stars have little asterisks on them. This is not all the stars within the volume, but those that have an asterisk next to them, when this plot was made a few years ago, 51 Pegasi, for example, Gamma Cephei, Upsilon Andromedae, down here, 55 Cancri, 47 Ursa Majoris. They all have these sort of oddball names, which we'll describe later. They're catalog names. Those are all stars that have had planets detected around them through various means. So when we expand our view out to 65 light years around the Earth, not only do we start picking up stars, but we have in the last few years started picking up stars with planetary systems. Most of these planetary systems that we're seeing have Jupiter-sized planets for reasons we'll discuss on Friday as to when we get into the searches. Let's go even further out to 250 light years around the Sun, and the vast space that we're searching for starts getting bigger and bigger. We start getting out into the space between the spiral arms of our galaxy, and we pick up a lot more candidates surrounding us. So as we go further out, we get a lot more stars, but it gets a lot harder to search for things around those stars, especially for searching for planets, especially if we want things like pictures of them and detailed study. And especially if we ever got it in our head to travel to one of these things, the challenges of interstellar distances become even greater. So this is just simply getting out to within 250 light years. This is an area where we have a pretty good chance of getting a reasonable census of stars out to that volume. It's actually pretty challenging outside 30 light years, but we're beginning to extend our technologies to get a thorough census of this volume. To put this in perspective, we have to ask, well, how does that fit into the larger system of stars that we live in, the Milky Way galaxy? The Sun is but one of 200 billion stars living in a large flattened disk of stars we call the Milky Way. Seen on a dark night sky, far from city lights, the southern hemisphere is the best place you could possibly go to see the Milky Way. It's beautiful from Chile, Australia, down around here. You can see it from South Africa. It's very much brighter than it appears up in the northern hemisphere because the center of the Milky Way goes nearly overhead at 30 degrees south latitude, because it's actually the center of our Milky Way is in the southern hemisphere. It's invisible. Pretty well, not entirely invisible, but it's so low on the horizon, it's not as spectacular. The Milky Way, with the central bulge of the Milky Way rising above the Andes, is one of the most breathtaking sights I've ever seen observing. It's one of the great reasons for being an observational astronomer. I get to go cool, dark places and see amazing skies. So this Milky Band, when you look at it with a telescope, resolves into billions upon billions of otherwise invisible stars. To the naked eye, it looks like kind of like a light, diffuse glow. It got its name from the Greek Galaxias Kuklos, the Milky Band that appeared to surround the entire celestial sphere. The Latins, Romans, using Latin, called it the Via Lactea, the road of milk. So that's why this has been translated as the Milky Way, as the name that we give to it today. The general description of systems like the Milky Way derives its name, galaxy, from the Greek word galaxias, which is the Greek word for milk. For those of you who know a little bit of biology will know that one of the sugars in milk is galactose. Or, if you're using Latin, lactose. Different lactose people who might be lactose intolerant, lactea and galaxias have similar roots. So a galaxy refers generically to any large, gravitationally bound assemblage of stars, which can range from a few million stars to many trillions of stars. Or, like our Milky Way, is a galaxy. We call the Milky Way specifically is our home galaxy. If we look at it from the outside, we have a pretty good view based on full-scale images of the sky taken with spacecraft. We can see that we are in the center of a very flattened disk, which has lots of dust and gas in the center. It bulges up in the middle, sort of going from this very flattened system, it kind of bulges up into a spheroid shape, consisting of mostly relatively old, fairly bright stars. The full size of this thing is really big. It's about 100,000 light years in diameter. These things don't have hard edges. They actually are kind of fuzzy edged on the outside. The thickness at the thickest portions is about 1,000 light years in thickness. So they're really long and thin, and the whole system is rotating around its center of mass. It's a very slow rotation. It takes the Sun about 250 million years to complete one orbit around the center of our Milky Way galaxy. We're not located near the center. Now, we've gone from a photograph of the sky that represents the Milky Way seen on edge. The fact that it's on edge is because we are down inside the plane. We're located about 26,000 light years away from the center, out here in the space between two of the spiral arms. And this is now not obviously a photograph, because we haven't sent a spacecraft straight out of the plane yet. But we can piece together the structure of the galaxy by looking in many wavelengths, mapping stars, mapping gas. And we can see that the galaxy has a sort of bright central, sort of bar-like region in the central bulge, kind of opens up into this kind of ring-like shape that's actually a pair of very tightly wound spiral arms that then unwind and become more raggedy as they move outwards. The Sun is located out here between these two arms, the Sagittarius arm and the Cygnus arm, and Cygnus and Orion arm, and is about 26,000 light years away from the center of our galaxy. So this is the system that we see when looking up at the sky at night, is we're seeing this bright band because we're sitting down in the middle of this flattened disk, and we're seeing the brightest portion just edge on, kind of painted across the sky in the distance. If we look at other galaxies around us, we can find a lot of galaxies that have very similar properties to the Milky Way, which gives us an idea of what the Milky Way would look like from the outside. Here's an example of one of those. You see this disk containing lots of gas and dust. That's why it gives it this cloudy appearance. Those are gas clouds out of which new stars will be formed. And the colors have been kind of tweaked up by the astronomers who took this to show the bulge more clearly, how it sort of bulges out into a spheroid from this disk. The galactic bulge is a spheroid population of older stars that orbits around the inner portion of our galaxy. It contains an awful lot of stars. Most of the bulge stars we see in there are actually older than the Sun. Reminder that our Sun is about 4.6 billion years old. The typical age of stars in the galactic bulge, on average, is around 10 billion years old. So this is a much older population of stars. The reason why I emphasize that is remember that one of the things we're thinking about when we're looking at possible places to harbor life is there must be enough time for evolution to occur, especially if we're interested in intelligent life. So maybe these older stars are the places where if life doesn't exist today, may have existed in the past. Also, the stars are much more densely packed out there than the solar neighborhood. We're in a relatively, we're way out in the suburbs. This is kind of the city of the galaxy. We went from 4 stars per 1,000 cubic light years around the Sun. Downside in the center portions of our galaxy, it's 3 stars per cubic light year. So the average distance between stars inside the center of our galaxy shrinks rather dramatically to a fraction of a light year. The stars are a lot closer together in there. So the bulge, when you add up all the space inside, is extremely populous. There are something like tens of billions of stars within the central couple thousand light years. So it's another obvious place to go looking for planets. The problem is it's really far away, but we've actually begun a search for planets around stars in the center of our own galaxy, and the main place that's doing that is, in fact, right here at Ohio State, with Professors Gould and Gowdy are leading an effort to use one of the methods we use to discover planets, both in the distant disk, as well as possibly we've found one now, so far, that is plausibly located in the bulge of our galaxy, many tens of thousands of light years away. We've found to date about a dozen planets by that method, so it's pretty exciting stuff. So this is what we're looking at. This is the hunting ground for looking for planets around other stars. It's this beautiful Milky Way. This is a beautiful photograph here, taken in time-lapse photography in a series of images to put together this band of the Milky Way. We have 200 billion stars inside of our Milky Way. Some fraction of those harbor planets. Some fraction of those probably harbor Earth-like planets within the habitable zones of their parent stars. And possibly some fraction of those may have had advanced forms of perhaps even intelligent life evolve on them. How many? Well, it's really hard to say. And part of what we'll be developing over the next couple of weeks is how we can go from what sounds like completely idle speculation, I wonder how many are out there, to how we actually go about making an informed estimate of that number. So this is our goal. We're going to go out into this space and ask, what are the criteria we're going to use to search for stars? Which kinds of stars should we be searching? Should we be so provincial as to only look at sun-like stars, or can we broaden the search? Where should we be looking? And finally, what should we be looking for? And those are the questions we're going to begin to address in subsequent lectures. Okay?